Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. And when we come back from this brief break, hearing traffic, we will talk about what's going on, the latest news from Madison, Wisconsin, with Don Taylor, who's a professor at the School of Workers in Wisconsin. We'll talk about that in a minute. Then we'll have a debate between Bill Berry and Ann McCarthy. Should public workers have the right to unions and collective bargaining? And what's happening is at the heart of all this. Stay with us for all that. But first, we're going to turn this over to WEAA traffic, check on the roads, and come back for the conversation. So please, stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We'll continue our coverage and looking at what's going on in Wisconsin. But first, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Before we turn to Bill Berry and Ann McCarthy, we're going to talk to Don Taylor, who is assistant professor at the School for Workers, part of the University of Wisconsin Extension, who has been participating in the demonstrations in Madison, Wisconsin. And Don Taylor, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi. Great to join you.
Thank you for being here. So tell us what the latest is today on the streets of Madison.
Well, the demonstrations at the Capitol building continue. They have grown in size just about every day. They might have gotten a little bit smaller when the cold winter weather returned to us on Monday, but on Saturday, I've seen estimates as high as 75,000 people in attendance at the Capitol, both inside and outside. Today, the governor spoke at an event sponsored by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, which is an industry employers lobbying group primarily. And I wasn't there myself, but I understand that a significant demonstration took place there as well.
So it's interesting to watch how this is kind of keeps on getting larger. There are more and more people in the streets and many of them union members and public union members. I'm curious where you think, as part of this, where this ends up going, because there seems to be this stalemate with the 14 Democratic senators still out of state, which means they can't vote on this particular issue at all. But then the Republicans within the state Senate are passing all kinds of other bills,
right.
And people are not leaving the streets. So where does this end up? So what happens here?
Well, that's the question everybody's wondering, I suppose. Of course, one way it could go would be for the governor and the legislative majority to decide to compromise on the issue. There are ways to fix the state budget, a multitude of ways to fix the state budget without rescinding collective bargaining rights for hundreds of thousands of people. That could happen. I don't know how hopeful I am that that will happen, but we're constantly hearing rumors that there are Republican members of the Senate who are on the fence and who are trying to broker a compromise. Don't know how true that is. Several employer groups, such as the Wisconsin Association of School Boards, which initially backed the bill, are starting to signal that they feel as though it's gone a little bit too far and that it's too divisive and that maybe some type of compromise has to be reached. Certainly that's what, everybody on the ground here is hoping for. I think everybody recognizes that the state budget, like most state budgets, is in a bit of a pickle. But I don't think anybody comes to the table thinking that, this is the time that we're going to walk away with, wonderful benefits and pay increases. Even prior to this crisis, public sector unions nationwide, not just in Wisconsin, have been agreeing to furlough days and wage freezes and, in some cases, wage cuts and higher payments on employee shares of health insurance premiums. So that's all within the realm of possibility if the governor and his people are willing to come to the table and do that. Of course, another way that they may choose to go, which we, again, hear rumors about, is that they could separate the provisions that relate to eliminating collective bargaining rights and separate them and put them in a separate bill, which would change the quorum requirement and allow the Republicans to pass it without the Democrats even being present. That's a possibility. Would obviously up the ante quite a bit and escalate things. The local labor federation has actually hasn't called for a general strike, but has passed a resolution saying that we should explore the possibility of perhaps planning for one. So if things turn sour here, I'm certainly not expecting any violence because people have been great about that. But things will certainly get bigger than they already are if somehow they do some legislative sleight of hand to pass the collective bargaining provisions separate from the budget repair bill.
Now, what about this prank call that took place between between Governor Scott Walker and Ian Murphy, a journalist from BuffaloBeast.com, posing as one of the Koch brothers?
Well, that obviously was news that broke, I think, last night or this morning.
Right.
I actually haven't listened to the call myself. My understanding is that the governor, that the caller didn't quite get the gotcha that side might have hoped for. But I think from what I understand, the caller himself said some pretty stern things about, you know, we really need to bust this union. And the governor didn't necessarily correct him or disagree. And again, I'm just saying what I've heard third hand or second hand about the call.
Yeah, I've just been in the transcript. We'll bring that up another day. Maybe play a piece of that. It was pretty. It was interesting. But I wonder what this is. What's taking place though now here? I mean, this is in many ways very unprecedented. And I want to give, if you have a chance here for a moment, just to give our listeners a sense of your sense of what it was like being in the midst of all that.
In the midst of what's going on at the Capitol?
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. You know, I've been involved in, you know, my background has been in labor relations. So, I've done my time on picket lines and demonstrations and things like that. But this has a very different feeling to it. It feels much more spontaneous. When the protests started early last week, there was no central authority, so to speak, from the state AFL-CIO or something like that organizing it. It just started happening, and there was really, you could say, nobody in charge. All these different groups, kind of in a bottom-up way, started organizing. And on the first day, several thousand people came, and the next day, several more thousand. And I frankly felt as though after that first day, well, that was a nifty little protest we just had. The turnout was pretty good. I'm speaking about last Monday. And then I think myself and everybody was surprised at the kind of the organic way that just thousands more people came to Madison every day. And it's not just public employees who are directly affected by this bill that are coming. You know, hundreds of electricians, hundreds of sheet metal workers. And, you know, you could name just about any group of workers that are out there, and they're down here camping out on the Capitol floor. That's the other thing that's been amazing to me, going up there at night. I personally haven't slept on the Capitol floor. I think I'm too many years past being able to sleep on a marble floor overnight and then being able to function the next day. But just bands playing on street corners and thousands of people in the street, and you go inside and another thousand or two people are wall to wall in this massive rotunda, chanting and singing. The night I was there, there was a young woman standing on an upturned garbage can in the middle of the crowd with a megaphone, leading them in chants and songs. And then every now and then she'd set down the megaphone and hand out bananas and bottles of water to people in the crowd. It's got an amazing spirit. And it's, as I said, it's like unlike any type of labor demonstration or rally I've ever encountered.
And before we take a break here and introduce other guests who will in our studio here, Bill Barry, who's Director of Labor Studies at the Community College of Baltimore County, mm-hmm. And Anne McCarthy, Associate Dean at Johns Hopkins Carey Business School, to kind of discuss and debate the issue of collective bargaining, what this all means for public unions and unions in general. That you're seeing unions outside the public union sector supporting this, because there have been a lot of reports saying that this is actually dividing the union movement.
Not really, no. I've seen absolutely no sign of that. That's frankly something some of us were worried about at first. Would some unions sit back and say, well, this doesn't affect us? I think they understand that ultimately it does affect everybody, because this is, if this thing passes, we're talking about a couple hundred thousand people whose purchasing power immediately goes down. And granted, during a bad economy, I think everybody understands that we all have to take a step or two back. But permanently limiting people's purchasing power and limiting the ability of working families to go to their local car dealership and buy a new car or hire the local handyman to do some renovations on the house, that's going to pull down the entire middle class and all working families. And I think I'm surprised at the number of unions and different types of workers that have really understood that right from the very beginning. I do understand that there's a little dissension in some of the law enforcement unions, because some law enforcement units are exempted from this bill, and there's at least one union that I'm aware of that has members. Some are affected by it and some are not, and there's some dissension there about where they should be on the bill. But that's very small and minor compared to the outpouring of support that I'm seeing.
Don Taylor, it's been great to talk to you, and we look forward to getting you back on the air with us as we watch this unfold. Don Taylor is assistant professor at the School for Workers, part of the University of Wisconsin Extension. Before I let you go, what is the School for Workers?
We're a labor education program. We're
okay.
The nation's oldest university-based labor education program since 1925. And we go out into communities and we offer training and workshops to union leaders. We offer labor management consultation to companies and their workforces, all with the idea of fostering effective workplace cooperation and problem solving.
All right, now I see the connection between you and our other guest, Bill Berry. So,
yes.
Don Taylor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to turn our attention now to Bill Berry, who's Director of Labor Studies at the Community College of Baltimore County, author of Union Strategies for Hard Times, and Ann McCarthy, Associate Dean of the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School and former Republican candidate for comptroller here in the state of Maryland. And both of you, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
Glad to be here as always, Mark.
So here we go. What were you uttering in the mic there, which you didn't get? I didn't quite hear what you were saying, Ann McCarthy.
When Don was talking about the other people from other unions being there sleeping on the floor, they're probably being paid by their union to show up and protest.
You don't know that.
I don't know that. I said probably.
Then
I didn't say definitely.
Why would you say something that you can't prove?
Probably is not a proof either way, but I can give you a personal experience. I do have a brother who is a member of a union who is frequently paid to show up and protest, often for things that have nothing to do with his particular union.
That's another question, but I think that what I know about Wisconsin, and obviously I'm not out there, there is a huge groundswell of support, and unionism has always been voluntary, going back to George Pulis. And he was the original union villain in 1806 at the Cordwainers trial. And he believed in unions, and he was ready to go to jail for it. And ever since then, yes, unions have been able to pay people to do stuff. But I think in Wisconsin, you're not going to pay 75,000 people to come out and sleep on the floor of the Capitol. I think there is a contagious enthusiasm, a sense of solidarity, and an excitement that we haven't seen in a long time.
I think that there is a group of people who feel threatened, and to quote Mark from 2 years ago, elections have consequences, and the people of Wisconsin voted a man into office who clearly said ahead of time this was his agenda. So the silent majority may be sitting home, but they voted last November, and I think that what we're seeing is a small amount of people relative to the larger voting population.
Well, I mean, does that mean that anybody in Maryland who's a Republican would simply agree with anything that Martin O'Malley wants to do? I mean, elections have consequences.
People have the right to say what they think.
Absolutely.
Which does not mean it's a huge groundswell.
Well, I think in Wisconsin it appears to be a big groundswell. It's picked up support all around, not only around the country, around the world. And the great story, as we were talking about it before, is this pizza place in Madison that's taking orders from China, from Egypt, places like that, to buy pizzas for the demonstrators.
They actually closed down their business and to do nothing but feed the demonstrators. People are all over the country. It's on our website as well.
And one of the things you're looking at is the economic impact. And we were just talking about how State Illinois is running a great thing. They've got all the runaway legislators in the state. So it's a huge tourist boom.
So, folks, we're talking here about the bottom line issue. One of the bottom line issues here is A, the state of unions in America and what you posited a couple of years back with your book, Bill Berry, about the busting up of unions, and B, should public employees have the right to unionize and collective bargaining, and why this is happening to public unions across the country, and what this battleground is. Let's start with first your thesis that you posited in your book last year, then let Anne McCarthy come back.
Well, what I looked at was the determination of the wealthy people in this country to eliminate unionism completely. And I used the example of the boiling frog. And an old fellow I work with from Georgia talked about the boiling frog, and he said if you put a frog in a pot, turn the heat up slowly, the frog will stay there till it's dead. But if you throw the frog into boiling water, it'll jump back out. And unionisms in this country have had the heat slowly turned up over the last 30 or 40 years. And Reagan was certainly an instrument of that. And we see the membership is down, laws passed, behavior by employers that would never have been able to go 35 or 40 years ago. And so the membership in private sector is down to where it was in 1900. We've been pushed back 111 years. In other unions, the private sector have been shredded, the auto workers in the negotiations. And I said in the book that they're going to come after the public sector next. And they're going to use the budgets. They're going to use the pensions. They're going to use this kind of elitism that the public sector unions don't do anything, workers don't do anything, as an opportunity then to go after the last group of significantly organized people in this country. And Wisconsin is clearly the boiling frog where the water was boiling. They threw the frog in and it jumps right back out. Because what this guy did was so dramatic. And he went to the legislature, according to a friend of mine up there, got $140 million in tax breaks after he was in. Companies like Walmart, places like that. Then claims he's got a financial problem and then uses that as the excuse to destroy the unions and disrupt collective bargaining. So I think what you're looking at are two areas, the financial part of public treasuries and where taxes are raised and not raised and spent and not spent, and the principles of whether or not people have a right to join a union and bargain with their employers.
Anne McCarthy.
Well, I think Bill was correct in his predictions, and I guess to me it's a moot point about whether it's the economic elite, which might be difficult to prove or disprove. To me, it's that people – to compare the steel workers in 2011 with the steel workers in 1900 and the conditions under which women and children worked at 1910 and when there was a real need for unions – today, it's like comparing apples and oranges. And I think that from a sociology point of view, unions have outlived their usefulness. And I don't think it's a right written in the Constitution that people have the right to collective bargaining. I don't see that anywhere.
I'm sorry, but it's not coughing into a comment. Coughing into a cough.
That's hard to swallow, eh, Mark?
Bill?
Mark's not part of a union.
I have a bigot's of him. I have been part of a union. I was part of the AFT. I was an organizer of the AFT, and I've been part of a bunch of unions in the past, but
well, I think that just because something is not in the Constitution, I mean, once upon a time, women couldn't vote, and did people say, "Well, it's not in the Constitution, therefore you shouldn't expect to vote"?
We changed the Constitution,
but they did, and perhaps changing
which is possible.
Perhaps changing the Constitution to enshrine collective bargaining, but the passage of laws, national
even
labor.
Even FDR didn't think that public servants should have the right to unionize.
I understand that for political reasons. He didn't think agricultural workers should either. And that was part of the political deal to get the National Labor Relations Act passed through Congress. We also threatened to pack the Supreme Court. I mean, there are lots of things going on. And public sector is the second step. And Wisconsin was the leader. to allow people to have the same rights to a contract, to due process, which they otherwise would not have under employee at will.
Well, let me ask this question.
Like, I still don't understand. I understand the history. I don't understand why it's necessary.
You know, we heard an interesting discussion.
Lots of private people don't – private institutions don't have collective bargaining. They are not unionized. Why is it necessary?
They will spend money. You should read Marty Levitt's book, Confessions of a Union Buster, where he talks about what he did and what he got paid for disrupting union campaigns. And
so that's one case. I still don't understand the primary – You can disagree with what he did, and you may not like him, but I don't understand why there's the right to collective bargaining. And nobody has convinced me yet why.
Okay.
Why do public employees need the right for collective bargaining when all kinds of other employees do fine without it?
I'm not sure they do fine without it. And I think you look at the stature of working people today, division of wealth in this country, and I think the absence of unions caused the recession and was a significant part in its continuation because – people don't have money in their pockets. You know, that rising tide is not lifting all boats. I think that what we're talking about here is simply a fundamental principle difference. And I'm listening to people talking today about gay marriage. And I talk to people and they say, well, I absolutely don't think people of different sexes have the right to get married and you can't prove it to me. And the answer is I probably can't prove it to you. I believe in something. And it's not in the law yet. Just as women's suffrage was not in the law yet at one point. But I'm hopeful that unionism will come back. I think movements like what we're seeing in Wisconsin are going to stimulate that.
Oh, I think the movements in Wisconsin are going to crash down on unionism across the 50 states. People who are not unionized are tired. Teachers don't care about students. They care about their union contracts.
Wait.
They behave as if they only care about their union contracts. And parents are tired of it.
You know, that is
– Look at what happened to Mayor Fenty. He took on the union. He got voted out by the union dues that people paid campaign against him.
I have children in the Baltimore City Public Schools, and my kids' teachers care for them. They are covered by a union contract. And to speak badly of the teachers, I really take exception to that. Are we all great? No. You will find students in my classes who think I'm a jerk. I care about them, and unfortunately, I'm not covered at this moment by a union contract. They do not care more about their union contract, but they do care about having a decent salary, decent working conditions, respect, due process. And I think Michelle Rhee had no concept at all of how to deal with teachers, how to deal with students. I think this race to the top, which is based on test scores and all the kind of stuff, is totally bogus. And it was seen here in Baltimore, where she may have manipulated the scores. So don't blame that on unionism.
Well, let me ask this question to both of you. I mean, I think the fundamental question here, and folks, you can join us, is right now in Wisconsin, there are 70,000 more people in the streets every day saying yes to the give back, but demanding that they have the right to unions and the right to collective bargaining. And this is the crux of the battle. Should public workers have the right to unionize and collective bargaining? What are your thoughts at 410-319-8888? You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. People have logged on to our Facebook account, Mark Steiner and Mark Steiner Show, and left their thoughts, which we're going to try to get to as well. We're here with Anne McCarthy, Associate Dean of the Johns Hopkins Carrier Business School, who says, no, there's no need for unions nor collective bargaining on the right of public workers. And Bill Berry, who's saying that without that, that workers will lose everything they have and it'll be the end of this country. 410-319-8888. The lines are drawn here in America and here in this room. What are your thoughts? Let's go to the phones. And I think it says Cylone. You're on the air. Our first caller up, can we bring him up, please?
Hello?
Hi, Salon, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is Tyrone.
Tyrone, okay, didn't say that. I'm sorry about that. Go ahead, man.
I wonder who that was. Now, I worked both union and non-union. And to the lady there, every time I've ever worked non-union, and then I'm talking about construction, I've been totally screwed. When I work union, I got, you know, the thing about it is, the union is the only way that you can confront the corporate cybersecurity. There's no way an individual can go, me as an individual can go to a firm and as a construction worker and tell them I want a raise. I can't do that alone. But with the backing of the union, I can do that. Okay, that allows me to bargain for my benefits, my health care, et cetera. The thing about the private sector unions, though, is that, and this is a check on that, is that if that company fails, you lose your job. So you're out of work. So in a way, you know, it's kind of different than the public sector, but you do have a right to assembly, and that is in the Constitution. As you read the Constitution, it says that the right of the people to peacefully assemble shall not be abridged or infringed. So that right is in the Constitution. It isn't written as union, but you can peacefully assemble. So, you know, so that right is in the Constitution. The thing about the public sector is that for years, the public sector employees have subsidized or incentivized companies to move overseas. This has resulted in the loss of jobs in the private sector, which really pays for the government, the private industry does. I mean, I don't think people realize that. 90% of people in the United States probably don't even realize that. And so there's no more money to put in the Treasury to pay for these jobs. So now what's happening is it's coming back to hit the public sector people. So, you know, their benefits can't be paid for. It can't be sustained by the private sector anymore because we sold everything overseas. This highlights the fact that we need to support private industry in this country, because otherwise everybody's going to suffer. And the unions have created the middle class. If you get Saturday and Sunday off, that's because of the unions.
Let me let them respond, and I'm glad your name is Tyrone and not Cyclone. I got it right now.
Oh my God. Probably better to be Cyclone.
Maybe you better be Cyclone. Yeah. I don't know.
Actually, I agree with Tyrone in the sense that he brings up a very good point. And yes, we have the right to assembly, but you know, if a private company fails, every union worker is out of a job. A public servant, a public worker, doesn't believe that the government is ever going to fail the government they work for, whether it's state, city, local, or federal, because the taxpayer is there to bail them out. And I think what I'm trying to say is that taxpayers are tired of it.
Well, I think a whole other show would be looking at public finances, because as I talked about last time I was here, I had an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun about it, and it's been trickled down. It's the local level needs something, they go to the state. State needs something, they go to the federal government. The federal government is like the fairy godmother or godfather, and everything trickles down. And I was thinking about that last week. There was a story about schools in South Baltimore that were having carbon monoxide poisoning. And the state senator down there said, oh, these are schools that are ancient, they're dilapidated, we need help. We'll get money from the state. Well, not going to happen. I think you look at the federal government, where their money goes. I think the invasions of Iraq, you know, you look at the figures, the amount of money, the trillions of dollars that have been spent over there, and their state-by-state accounting. Guy in the last week had a calculation that if you bring back 151 soldiers from Afghanistan, the Wisconsin budget crisis goes away. My argument last year was that if you suspend the war for 63 minutes, Baltimore City deficit is covered. And so you can't – that's the elephant in the – one elephant in the room, along with health care. And you can't take those off the table. You can't kind of pretend they're not there, because we have developed since the 30s a dependence on federal government to subsidize a lot of state and local areas. And people have made political careers in Maryland by being sent – you know, the earmarks.
You know, this is a corollary of what you're saying, Bill, but the stimulus package did work in the sense that it prevented all of this from happening last year.
It forestalled it.
So this is the result of stimulus dollars drying up. We would have been facing this a long time ago if it hadn't been for the Obama administration. And I'm not saying that that's bad. I think it was helpful. It kept people in jobs longer.
And someone wrote in earlier, if we can take a break here, someone wrote in earlier that what you said, I think it was they said 180, maybe it's 150, whatever the number is of soldiers, with the cost for a year would have wiped out the Wisconsin.
$1 million a year per soldier.
And that if they taxed 13 hedge funds managers, there would be no deficit in. Mm-hmm. They could not would be, but that would be equivalent to the deficit of Wisconsin and other states as well. 410-319-8880. We have to take a very brief break. We come back. Mike D. Klondike Peter. We'll read something, an interesting thing from David Anthony Wiggins on our website, who leans more towards where Anne McCarthy is sitting, and we'll talk about those issues. 410-319-8888. Do workers have the right to unionize if they're public employees? That's the heart of the matter. And what will that mean for the union movement and America? Where this ends up, I think we'll have to define a lot of that for the future of our country. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food, design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. The heart of the struggle and battles going on right now in Wisconsin are over the right of public unions, unions of public employees, to collective bargaining. And there's a that's a debate that is dividing America right now. It's at the heart of this. And we have with us in the studio Bill Berry, Director of Labor Studies at the Community College of Baltimore County and author of Union Strategies for Hard Times, and Ann McCarthy, Associate Dean of the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School and former Republican candidate for Comptroller of Maryland. You can guess which side each one's on. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And let's go to Mike in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Good evening, folks.
Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
First of all, I want to commend a certain consistency with that Republican woman that's one of your panelists. For, as she pointed out, and apparently Mark said this at some previous time, you get what you vote for. People in Wisconsin voted for a liar, and they got lied to. What's a big surprise? I mean, there ain't no time when he was running for office, he said, I'm going to bust the unions. That didn't happen. He lied. And if we can't at least begin with that recognition of factual reality, you're on another planet. Now, then there's a let me get to this issue of do people have some kind of intrinsic right to unions, public employees or anybody else? Fact is, I'm sorry, no, they don't. That ain't in our genes. You got to fight for it. And if you ain't ready to fight these people, you're going to pay the sad price. We have to fight them. Oh, and lastly, by the way, I was a public school teacher. My son is a public school teacher now. And this idea that we're in it for the money, what planet do you live on?
What planet do you live on, Ann?
I think it's the United States of America, planet Earth. But we do. We deserve what we vote for. And I'm glad that you were a dedicated public school teacher, but not all public school teachers are dedicated.
Do you really believe that most public school teachers are not dedicated to the kids and their work? They only care about their money?
I believe that the way their unions represent them, they care more about their contracts than they care about what's going on in the classroom. Because if they didn't, our state of education wouldn't be as abysmal as it is. We have people who are not qualified to be in classrooms that are protected by their unions. And don't tell me that that doesn't go on.
Well, I think that what union contracts do is provide due process. And nobody wants to see bad teachers. And once again, I'm going to stick up in general for the teaching profession, both the part-timers and the full-timers at the community college. And I don't know a teacher there who doesn't care about the students. And we don't have a union yet, but we care. And as I said, my kids have both been through Baltimore City Public Schools for their whole period. I never found a teacher that didn't care.
Well, and perhaps caring is a bad term. Well, competence might be a better term.
Yeah, I mean, but that's all in the eye of the beholder.
No, it's not. If you can't pass a basic math test, then you're not competent.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a whole other question of how student success is evaluated.
No, I mean the teacher can't pass a basic math. Right. Several years ago, the state of Massachusetts gave tests to their teachers, and half of them failed.
Well, quite frankly,
they had to readjust the test.
Quite frankly, I teach history. I probably couldn't pass the college math test today either.
Well, no comment then.
No, but I think that was one of the flaws in the test, was that if you're teaching history and you didn't pass the math test, well, you know, some of us might not be able to pass the math test, but there may be many mathematicians may not be able to pass a history test.
All right. I think this has gone into the absurd redundant.
How's that absurd?
Because the point is that if you look at the large scale, our public schools are failing. If they weren't failing, then we wouldn't have the movement for charter schools and the sort of affection with teachers' unions.
Right or wrong about
individual teachers.
410-319-8888, D, you're on the air.
Am I on the air?
You're on the air, D.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mark. Mark, this is such a good show. First of all, I just want to say, the female guest that you have there who's a Republican.
Ann McCarthy.
Yeah, I am offended by the fact that she is trying to demonize unions. I'm a teacher. I'm on my way right now to Kinko's to buy paper so I can get my kids ready for MSA in 2 weeks. All right? You know, that's just my only point. Teachers work hard. Of course, you know, there are lazy teachers. You know, there are lazy police. You know, there are lazy firefighters. You know, there are lazy, people in every profession.
Probably lazy college administrators, too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay.
So. That's true. And
absolutely.
People keep talking about election has consequences. Now that corporations can pump as much money as they can, into elections, you're going to systematically see elections not being reflective of the majority of the people. So we have to be mindful of that.
Unions also can pump money into elections. And, in fact, it was the unions that tried to unseat Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas.
Did
unseat Fenty in D.C. So this is not a one-sided thing that corporations are bad and unions are, the angels of the world that don't get in there and spend hundreds of thousands
pockets,
and millions of dollars on campaigns. That's they do.
Corporations have deeper pockets, compared to union dues. Tell me. You can't compare the two.
Dee, we appreciate your thoughts. Let me read a quick thing from the Facebook and then go right back to our callers. David Anthony Wiggins wrote in on our Facebook page, isn't the issue really about all the government pensions that were gambled away on Wall Street and the fact that the unions now want to balance the pension debacle on the backs of the taxpayer? After all, each individual state employee elected to allow the state to invest their pension or not. Since the government has no money of its own, why should we all be made to pay for the greed of those who elected to invest their pensions in Wall Street?
I don't know any.
It's more complex than that. And the pension fund predated the meltdown, the most recent meltdown recession. And the problem there is that public pension funds use a discount rate of 8%, which is a very risky rate, and it allows states and municipalities to put in less money. So public pension funds have been underfunded for over a decade. And if they were to adopt the rules that most economists say that they should adopt, which is to use a less risky discount rate, they would have to put more money in up front, which is not what they're doing. They've been playing almost a game of roulette with the stock market. Well, first of all, pension funds should not be in the stock market. They should be in something safe like treasury bonds. So that's a big game that all the states and municipalities have been playing.
I think she's absolutely right. And I think the private sector taught them how to do it. And you look at Bethlehem Steel and General Motors, General Electric wouldn't put money into the funds. They chronically underfunded, even illegally underfunded under ERISA. And what happens is then the demographics change. You have older workers, some layoffs, and the fund goes under. And there's no question. But I think, we've had this discussion before on the show. People have a fundamental right to a happy, secure, prosperous retirement. It's not written in the Constitution, but I believe that's what we should be able to do. There's no fun working at age 80 at Walmart as a greeter because your pension doesn't provide for you. And I think it's very important. I think Social Security was founded in that way, and I think that the pensions need to be funded. It goes to the topic we talked about before, how public agencies fund themselves or not. And they collect taxes from the people who could pay, and or have they relieved a lot of the corporations of the responsibility?
Let me return to the phones here. 410-319-8888. See, the next caller up would be Klondike, and then we go to Maggie. Klondike, you're on the air.
Okay. Hello, Mark Steiner and your guest.
Welcome.
My view is I'm for unions. For 34 years, I worked, was employed union. I'm retired 2001. Since that time, I've had a couple of full-time jobs and working for a temp agency now. What I have noticed, all of the jobs I've had since retirement, they're not union, and I'm looking at the employees. People tolerate a lot when it's not union. With a union job, it gives you your guidelines. You have everything. The union protects the employee. It also protects the company. Then another statement in reference to teachers that Ann McCarthy made, teachers are special people. In our country, we need to put teachers up on a pedestal. Teachers are human beings. You have good teachers and you have some that's not. But I choose to believe that the majority majority of teachers are good. I can look at within my own family. They spend a lot of money on these students out of their own pocket. Some people will say, yes, they can take it off their income tax. They will never get back what they spend out of their pockets, buying coats, buying paper. The school doesn't even supply enough paper. You have to have a copier at home for your assignments. Children can't take books home. So all of these things, these aren't the guidelines of the teacher. These rules were made with the Department of Education. And then another thing, I think people should listen to students, especially the younger students. We do not listen to what children are saying. Adults would learn a lot if they listen to children.
Glenda, I'm sorry. Thank you so much for your call. Let me get a couple of callers and let you both back in. Is that right? 410-319-8888. Peter in Carroll County, you're on the air. Then we go to Maggie. Peter, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to make a point about the right to organize and whether it's actually in the Constitution or not. I would point out that we do have a supremacy clause in the Constitution, which means that the treaties that the United States ratifies are the supreme law of the land. And in fact, we have a similar supremacy clause in the Maryland State Constitution that says the same thing. And we in the United States have signed a number of human rights treaties and participate in a number of human rights organizations, including the UN and the Organization of American States, that embrace the right to organize. It's also a right, I think, that exists under the First Amendment and the freedom of association. So, you know, this idea of one day we'll get into the Constitution, I think, is not really a relevant discussion. It is a human right. The right to organize is a human right. And the fact is that it makes no difference whether you're in a private sector or a public sector. The ability to come together to act collectively is a means of protection for any worker, regardless of who the employer is.
All right, Peter, thank you so much. Let me get another call in here. I'm going to let these guys kind of close out our hour here together because we have to leave a little early tonight because of Morgan basketball. 410-319-8888.
We know where the priorities are.
I didn't make those rules. And though I do like basketball. Maggie, you're on the air.
I really enjoy your show. It's literate and it's intelligent, and you have a lot of different voices. I like the points that the last two callers made, and I would like to add this. When the narrative shifts, as the media likes to use that word, from focusing on the fact that we have come through a terrible fiscal debacle that was not caused by these workers, that was caused by people on Wall Street, people in banks, people who have not yet been held to account, who have not yet, we've not had a reckoning. And what I find so curious is that there seems to be absolutely no comprehension among certain people in this society that there really does need to be a balance, that we have now become a society of oligarchies, of corporate oligarchies, and that until people wake up and see what has happened to the money and the wealth of this country and start realizing how that equates to power and who has it and what it will mean for them. I do not understand people like your Ms. McCarthy who somehow think that the trickle-down theory works. It doesn't. Whole human history shows that that doesn't work. What's going on in the Middle East? You have people who have...
Maggie, I'm almost out of time here, and I deeply appreciate your thoughts. I'm sorry that we have a shortened program this evening, but I'd like to try to get another call or two in if I can, but I want to give both the two of you at least a minute here, starting with Ann and Bill, where you think this all takes us.
Okay, well, so first of all, I do think most teachers are dedicated people, having been a teacher myself. But I will say this. I separate the right to engage in collective bargaining from a trickle-down theory. I agree with her. We have too much of a disparity between the rich and the poor with the disappearing middle class. And what's made this country great is a middle class. But that doesn't mean that collective bargaining among public servants is the way to get that. The way to get that is to go to the polls and elect somebody who will revise the tax code and make sure that the wealth does not concentrate in the hands of a few. That's a tax code issue. That is not a public servant collective bargaining issue.
I would certainly agree with that. That public policy to redistribute the wealth is a great idea. I would also say, though, that the creation of the so-called middle class was the union movement because it raised wages. It brought us up, brought health insurance, brought retirement. As one caller said, it brought us the weekend. And without that, we're all going to be working as if we were in Bangladesh.
Now, I want to thank both of you for being here tonight, Anne McCarthy and Bill Berry.
Thank you, Mark.
For the volume of callers and letters we've gotten, we're going to come back to this next week because this issue is going to be one of the most important issues facing the United States of America, and we'll let you all in this conversation along with our guests. Thank you both for being here tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland's Women's Health for every stage of a woman's life, offering compassionate care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services from routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. More information at 1-800-492-5538 or www.umm.edu/Women's Center. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered tonight by Zachary Coleman. Our intern this evening is Justin Green. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, find out information about our topics and our guests, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Thanks for participating in the show tonight.